be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hello, we are back. Welcome to Vintage Annals Archive Outsider Podcast. We've had about a month off because life's been hard. I started full-time teaching again. I had tried really, really hard to make doing this and my photography my job, but the economy is not built for that at the moment. So I'm a teacher. I like teaching. It's good because I get to do both things. I have a lot of off time. Anyway, very excited about today's guest is Ashleita Beauchamp. I met Ashleita through, I do a podcast on Minx. Amazing show. If you haven't seen it, go get stars, watch both seasons. It's amazing. And I did a call out for different fans of Minx, and Ashleita had done a magazine called Peekaboo. There are two of them now. They're amazing. I would I think the first one might be sold out, I'm not sure, but there's two volumes. I will give you the information in this podcast about how to find them. But I'd recommend them. And, you know, I was supposed to do like a 15-minute interview just about their connection, because they based their magazine on the fictional magazine in Minx. And we just started talking, and I realized it was its own episode, and we got into all kinds of things, into their burlesque, into horror films, into kind of being black and being in some feminism in terms of horror and how it plays out. And we just had a really great conversation. So I'm very proud. This is the first episode of season two, episode 53. And just to read Ashleita's bio: glamour ghoul, intersectional feminist, and smut peddler, Ashleita is a burlesque dancer from Hollywood, California. She's also the creator of Peekaboo magazine, a Playboy-style horror magazine that features artful nudes of your favorite monsters alongside social conscious think pieces. You can find her on Instagram at Ashleita, A-S-H-L-E-T-A, to follow her various creations. I recommend doing that. And again, this is also kind of very fitting for Halloween, so enjoy. I guess the question I would have, if you know, if we compare your magazine to the fictional Minx magazine, what are the similarities, and what issues are you addressing in the magazine you're putting out?
So our first issue, we're working on the second one right now, but our first issue, we had a lot of articles about you know, diversity in film and the film industry. We had an article about Monkey Paw Productions and, you know, the presence of Black people in the horror community. We have an article about disability portrayed in horror movies. Then we have a second one kind of extrapolating that idea in our second issue. So our first issue, it was kind of someone who had watched a horror movie and that had a disability and felt seen by the movie. And then in this upcoming issue, it's more how disability is portrayed in horror films. And then in this upcoming issue, we also have an article about kind of the rise in Jewish horror films.
Wow.
Because I noticed there's like a lot of, all the possession films are all like Catholicism.
Yeah.
And I watch horror movies a lot. So I noticed that there started to be kind of this uptick in horror movies that were portraying like Jewish, what's the term I want to use?
Iconography
and culture. And so I really thought that would be really interesting, because it's not something that I think has as much exposure as like Catholicism.
Interesting.
So I reached out and I said, you know, are there any Jewish writers that are also horror fans? And I found a really great writer, and she wrote an article for us, so that'll be in the next issue.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are some issues in terms of horror, and you know, how in terms of your either their experience that you read, or your own experience, how is that shown in a negative or positive light? And
so I think there's a lot of negative portrayals in terms of like disfigurement it's always, you know, someone who's disfigured is always a villain, or they're always scary or someone to be uneasy around. I know they brought up the film Run, which is about a girl who's in a wheelchair, and okay. Her mom kind of has like a Munchausen syndrome issue. And so I don't think that they thought it was like the best portrayal. But it was really interesting to read what they had to say. And then for the first issue, it was kind of about feeling seen by these characters in a horror movie who were disabled. And they had this like horrible fate happen to them, and people were able to do it because they were disabled and they didn't really have the means to advocate for themselves. So the writer, Shannon, felt really seen by that. So she kind of wrote an article about that in more of a positive light.
I want to segue a little bit to the Jewish content you're talking about, because one, so like when we started the podcast, I don't know, essentially there's a, I'm Jewish. It was going to be a Jewish project. It felt too limiting, but we have a separate Jewish podcast. So I'd like us to maybe just dig into this for maybe 10 minutes if we can.
Yeah.
Cause I'd like to release this episode over there as well. And I guess, I don't know if you've seen Beau Is Afraid.
No, I haven't seen it yet.
To me that, I had to research more to figure out the Jewishness, but it was written by Avi, I forget his last name. He's Jewish. I believe he's Jewish. But it's basically like, you know, Jewish mothers are kind of like, I mean, like any other mother, but to, you know, as a Jew, Jewish mothers are a lot to deal with. But I feel like everybody would probably say that about their own mother, you know, their own categories of mother. I mean, it's no different from any other mother, but there's a little more anxiety in there, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I love my mother, but she has a doctorate in figuring out ways to worry about things that you would have never imagined being a fear or anxiety that. And so, Beau Is Afraid is essentially about him visiting his mother, but like 3 hours of it goes all over the place. What were some films you found, either historically or that are new, or what was the piece you did for that magazine based on?
So I didn't write it, but because I felt like it wasn't my place, but it was something that I felt was really important and something that I noticed. So I wanted to open up that platform to a Jewish writer. And she basically discussed a couple of films that have come out. Possession, it came out in like the mid 2000s. Okay. It's about a Dybbuk. Then there is Dead Relatives, which is interesting because it's about a vampire who has a strange daughter that he didn't know he had. And when she meets him, he kind of talks about the story of how he came to be a vampire. And it has a lot to do with the Holocaust, which I feel like they do in a tasteful way. Instead of like being murdered, he is like transformed into a vampire, and that's how he survived all these years. But then he has all of this, like, I have no family left. And so he like builds this connection with his daughter, and he teaches her about her culture. And I thought it was a really sweet and beautiful story. There's another story called Attachment. And it's really interesting because it's a queer-led horror story, and it's about this couple, and one of the girls is Jewish and one I think is like agnostic, and they form a relationship, and they go back to visit their mother, one of the characters' mothers, and it turns out that she's possessed by a Dybbuk. And the story kind of progresses through there, and it's about like her partner trying to help her and figure out and navigate kind of Jewish culture without, you know, stepping on any toes. And then there's another one, what's the name of it? It's about a man who has a shomer, where you have to like watch over the body.
Okay.
And like the first 24 hours of death. So it's about that, and kind of what happens in the house while they're watching over the body, and the house just happens to be haunted as well. So I just kind of noticed that there was like a lot of stories about, you know, Jewish culture through the lens of horror that I'd never heard before, and that I didn't feel like were very prominent with mainstream horror. That's
really interesting. I don't know if you know much about the Gollum, who is like the Jewish Frankenstein.
I know that's another one of those stories she covered, but I haven't seen. I haven't seen that movie. There's like a movie also.
After doing the first magazine, what did you learn? What did you what informed the second magazine from after the first process?
So for the first magazine, from the idea to conception and publishing, it was about 4 months, which was not enough time at all. So we stayed up until 4 a.m. for like the last week of finishing up the magazine, like every night. My partner's a graphic designer, so I would do the layouts and he would clean everything up.
Okay.
But it was not enough time and we got really stressed. And I think there's like a couple like spelling errors in there that we missed, even though we did have like a proofreader. So really giving myself enough time was a big lesson, and anticipating more interest, because we sold out immediately and then a lot of people were asking for issues and I was like, I don't have them. So this year we're reprinting volume 2 and we're going to do like a bigger print volume, because even when we like sold out and it was like months later, people were still interested and they were like, well, I've never heard of that. Is it for sale? And then it'd be sold out. So
that's really amazing. Congratulations on that. It's really amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And so yeah, basically giving myself time, I think, was the biggest lesson that I learned from the last magazine printing, because I feel like it went really well. I have a really great team of people, which is something I felt like was similar to Minx. I really wanted to make sure that my team, my makeup artist, photographer, they all had this feeling that they owned part of the magazine as well. I'm really big on everyone I hired you because I trust you. So I'm going to let you give me your vision and I will work around that. And I think in the beginning, I didn't communicate that well. And people were like, well, you're not telling us what you want. And I was like, well, I just want you to give me what your vision is. And I think the pictorials turned out really amazing. And this year I'm like paying for my team to have their own like portrait shot. But that's something that I really pulled from watching the show, was like, make sure that your team feels supported and appreciated.
Had you read anything about Ellen or how she organized the show at all before doing that?
No, I mean, I read about kind of like the inspirations beforehand, like Suck and Viva magazine and like Playgirl, and just like how it came to be from like those inspirations, but like not really anything else.
I think what's tricky, I'm in the same boat too, having a small team with the podcast. Like I feel like you have to give them your vision, then let them kind of take it and do what they want. But sometimes it's a weird message to have a vision and then tell them, do your best with this. Because I think if you don't have I'm not criticizing you, I'm just saying for me, I'm understanding that if they don't understand the vision, it's hard for them to go on their own way and do something with it.
Yeah, I mean, I do send them like basic like layouts of what I want. I send them like mood boards and stuff. I'm very hands-on when it comes to like posing the models. But yeah, I kind of give them like a basic outline of what I'd like. So like the last shoot we just did was Ash from Evil Dead. And we used my friend's beautiful 70s fireplace with wood paneling, so it looked like a cabin. So I sent the photographer a photo and I was like, here's Burt Reynolds on the mank on the floor. This is kind of what I want. And then here are some stills from the movie.
Oh, very and cool.
Go with what you want. So like she picked like a specific lighting she thought would look best. And, sometimes I give her like a general idea in terms of sets. Like I'll be like a boudoir set, like give me like a couch or a lounger and you know, you can pick the colors or whatever, but here's the concept, here's the model, here's kind of the idea of what I want. And then with the models, I always say, I have poses in my head beforehand because I used to model. So I'm very hands-on with models. Where I'm like, move your foot this way, move your foot that way, you know? And I think it helps them feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are people who like haven't modeled before. So yeah, like comfort is really important to me on set. And I let people kind of dictate the amount of nudity that they want. So they're comfortable. And, but yeah, I give a basic outline, but you know, I want the photographers to feel, the makeup artists to feel like it's theirs as well.
So I'm just curious on in terms of movies or magazines or anything, what has done that well? What I mean, I feel like other things must have inspired your knowledge when you saw Minx of this world you wanted to emulate.
So I take a lot of inspiration for my magazine for a little bit earlier than the 70s magazines that she referenced. I go to flea markets a lot and I've found a lot of vintage pornography.
Nice.
Like there's this one magazine, it's a French magazine. It's kind of marketed to lesbians.
Okay.
So the photos and the gaze is kind of different. It's like, you know, very like soft and like natural and they're not really posed. But I love the idea of like kind of a softer look at the human body. I also have a bunch of like old pinup magazines, like I think Whisper is one of them, where it has
I love the really names famous... of I love the names of all the magazines. There's yeah, all, they're all just perfect.
All the really like famous pinup artists that would paint the cover.
Nice.
And I think Dita Montes has actually the original one of the covers. I like bought a lot of 60s Playboys because I love the set design. I love just the hair, the makeup, like the aesthetically, that's kind of like my favorite in terms of like how people are styled and how the sets are styled. Nice. And then Fangoria.
Yeah. I used to get Fangoria when I was a kid.
And then I found a bunch of like, I go to a lot of horror conventions as well, and I'd find a bunch of like horror smut mags from the 90s.
Yeah.
So I bought a bunch of those, and I kind of, the layouts itself are like kind of inspired by like Vogue, Playboy, and Fangoria, and Famous Monsters of Filmland. So like that's where the page layouts are from. And then the models are kind of, I try and emulate like 60s Playboy because I feel like that's when Playboy was at its peak in terms of pictorials. So yeah, it's like a lot of like vintage sets, vintage hair. Everybody has like a beehive. Everybody has, you know, the double eyeliner, bouffants. That's kind of how the monsters are styled. So like this issue, the new issue coming out, it's all 80s like horror iconography, but they're all styled as if they were 60s Playboy models.
It's tricky to understand Hugh Hefner because there was like a 7-part, I don't know if you watched this, it was like a 6-part.
Secrets of Playboy?
There was a documentary, but there was also like a show, like a docudrama. And I might be confused. I might be confusing them as two separate things.
The Hugh Hefner story?
Yeah.
On Prime. Yeah, I've seen it. It's interesting because I like hyper fixate on Playboy, but like I'm not really the biggest fan of Hugh Hefner.
Well, and I think he, you know, he's a tricky character because for some people, men and women included, might, he kind of sold himself as, he definitely promoted freedom.
Yeah.
Overall. Now.
But on the backs of the women in his magazine.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, let's, no. I fully see that. I hear you and I agree. And it's problematic. But I also feel like Playboy, if we, not that we can take that out, we shouldn't, it did open up a lot of freedoms for a lot of people in a certain sense.
Oh yeah, for sure. And he did a lot of interviews with Black civil rights activists, which I appreciate as well.
So I mean,
in like 1973, I want to say was the first time he had a Black woman on the cover of his magazine.
Yeah.
I actually have that issue. There's an interview with Malcolm X. So it's weird because like, I do understand what you're saying because there's this kind of like, I really love 60s Playboy. I really love the articles. I love how the women were shot. I love, you know, how beautiful it is. And so it's like this double think of like,
yeah,
Hugh Hefner was, you know, not the greatest person. He didn't treat his partner
well. No, he did horrible.
But he also created this thing that I think was very revolutionary and gave a platform to a lot of people who normally wouldn't have one.
Yeah.
So I definitely agree. It's
and like I fully, I don't like want to
double think.
And I don't want to imply that he did. I mean, he seemed like he just was horrible to women. I know there's probably hundreds of stories of him doing horrible things, him allowing horrible things to happen. And I don't want to discount that at all. But the reason I bring it in is because I feel like what's cool about the show is it doesn't make it black and white for anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and I think they made some really smart choices. Like Doug, Doug is a business person, but I don't think he's a porn person. Like he doesn't seem to get off on the power. He doesn't seem to like, he's not, I don't think, you know, he's not seen as like a scummy guy in terms of how he treats women.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, what he's doing
might. I definitely noticed, and I really, it makes you root for him, even though he's like doing and making really bad decisions sometimes. Yeah. Right. With the newest episode, I just watched episode one, and I was like, I don't want to like say spoilers, but the way in which he kind of had a grand gesture to rekindle whatever their business relationship was, I thought was like, if you're going to do it, like that's the way you do it. Like he understands what she wants and what she needs. And I really am rooting for him. You know, I still root for him.
Yeah. And I think, you know, also like, I think it also handles feminism in a way where it's like, it's showing that there was women that, you know, it's showing that there was different opinions on feminism. And, you know, and I feel like, especially that scene where she goes to the college and she's interviewing all the, like, you know, that's a pretty it's representing militant thoughts and, you know, in some ways, I mean, people can be smart as hell in college, but they're not usually when you're 21, 22 or 19, you haven't figured all of it out. And I just love again that like she's, there's, it's not black and white. And I just feel like it's such a smart way to do it. What I want to ask you is in terms of like the female gaze or the male gaze, how you thought that show handled it. And then I kind of want to get into where you think we are as a culture in terms of that kind of stuff. Is it getting worse? Is it getting better?
So the shoots in the magazine, I think, are so the original ones, besides that one, the Christmas one, which kind of got like out of the vision of the main team. But the character Richie, I really love the way he kind of elevates the models to be like pieces of artwork. Like I love the scene where he does the Michelangelo kind of, I think that was the episode where I was like, I want to do this, but with like horror movies and monsters. Yeah. There's also a queer lens, which I appreciate. And I just think it's more about the model and less about like the parts of the model. It's about the person as a whole. I think that's kind of what I got from the magazine. And that's kind of how I wanted to. Our magazine, it's men, women, basically all gender identities.
Nice.
So it's not just females in the magazine. I just really love the way that they kind of saw the model as like a whole person rather than like their parts that were titillating. I think nowadays, I think it's getting better, but I definitely think there's a lot of backlash. Against kind of the rejection of the male gaze. I think there's a huge backlash against that, and it's kind of scary.
What do you mean what do you mean by rejection of the male gaze?
I like the biggest reference I can think of is like in film.
Okay.
Where we had this is going to be so random, but mostly cool. Like Margot Robbie. If you look at Margot Robbie in Suicide Squad, the way she's dressed, there's like an article about this too, the way she's dressed, her hair and like her overall look and the gaze and the shot she gets. And then we get Birds of Prey, which is the same character, but it's a female director.
Gotcha.
And she's styled differently. She's still like, you know, very sexy, but it's less about like her, how her ass hangs out or, you know, like what, like how much of her cleavage is showing or like her pigtails or like pigtails that you could grab if you wanted. And it's like still the same style, but it's kind of, again, more about like, she's sexy as a person and like who she is and, you know, how she interacts with everybody in the movie rather than like, look at her and her small, small outfit and we're going to zoom in on her ass. It's like, that's like the best way I can describe it. And then I feel like there's a huge backlash for it. And like, especially like with the Barbie movie, like men are so mad that it's like,
that it's not about them, but go on.
Yeah, basically. Yes. And so we're getting all this like really weird, kind of scary backlash because we're seeing like women kind of take, and the queer community take kind of ownership of these like sexy characters, and kind of taking away the male gaze and putting in something that's like more than their parts. It's kind of like they're sexy because of who they are.
Yeah.
And they also look sexy, but it's not like, here's my ass and I'm bending over and you're zooming a camera up into it.
I feel like horror has really been it's been a unique system to really speak about like feminism and racism. What are some of the films in your understanding of horror that you feel like really nailed some big issues?
So I'll go in like chronological order. So obviously Night of the Living Dead was when we had our first like kind of black hero. And the character wasn't written to be black, but the guy who ended up in the role just happened to be the best guy for the role. And it changed the context of the film completely. I think that when you add diversity into your films, the context always changes. Hmm. A random example of this is the musical Little Shop of Horrors. They had a trans woman playing Audrey in at the Pasadena Playhouse, and it completely changed the context of their character and like deepened it. And you know, the song she sings have more meaning than before, because we know you know, how trans people are marginalized. So kind of that's kind of a one example of like how adding people of color and marginalized identities into film and media deepens the context of what's happening. So then kind of in the 90s, we had People Under the Stairs, which was written by and directed by Wes Craven, white man. But I feel like the way it dealt with classism and racism and like the housing, and low-income housing, and I thought it was like really shocking to see something that came from, you know, this white director that really felt like it recognized, you know, how Black people are treated in society and how classism affects them and housing insecurity. And I thought it was really interesting. And then, you know, like we can get into like Get Out and, you know, Nope, and other films like that. The film I mentioned that was Attachment, I feel like was such a great representation of both the Jewish community and lesbianism.
Yeah.
I'll
have to watch that.
Yeah, it's on Shudder. There's a documentary called Queer for Fear on Shudder,
okay,
which talks about horror through a queer lens. It's amazing. There's so many films in there. Queer for Fear.
You know, I don't know. I think the thing about horror, I don't know, for me, like, it's this balance of like, even in some ways, the more schlocky it is, the more of a message they can bring in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a big advocate of practical effects, which is why obviously like we have FX artists that work on the magazine. You know, I feel like I try and lean towards characters that have more need for practical effects, so our makeup artists can really do, really like get into the character and kind of do everything she wants and have a really a lot to work with and a lot to show of her art. I mean,
what are some other horror movies we're on the topic that just you feel like really nailed? I don't know. I mean, you can look at like The Final Girl as a, you know, an idea that taps into feminism if done right.
Yeah. Weirdly, I feel like Rosemary's Baby is a pro-choice movie, even though the director is like Roman Polanski, but it's just like in terms of like feminism. I feel like, yeah, Rosemary's Baby is like weirdly, I feel like a pro-choice film. I remember the scene in which she's very sick during her pregnancy, obviously because she's giving birth to like a demon, but she's throwing a party and all the women pull her into the kitchen and they're like, why are you letting your husband like tell you how to have your pregnancy? You know, you need to get a second opinion. And I remember seeing that scene and be like, wow, this is like amazing. All these women are kind of like being this safe space for her and trying to get her to advocate for herself and telling her that she needs agency over her own pregnancy, whether or not she wants to keep it. So I feel like that's a really great example of like unexpected feminism in a film. I feel like people don't really pick up on that for Rosemary's Baby, but I feel like it's completely a pro-choice.
It reminds me of the scene, it didn't bring it back to Minx, and the scene in Minx where she's out with all the Italian mafia wives, and they kind of bring her in, and you know, it's not exactly the same. But did you see the recent movie? I don't know what it's called. I just watched it. It's the tagline is like, we can't all die.
Oh my God, The Blackening.
What did you think of that?
So I also have a side project that's called The Bechdel Test, and it's like the Bechdel Test, but it's like, you know, do they talk about racism? Is there more than, you know, one Black person? Do they die first? Are they a sacrificial Negro? Are they like killed first? So yeah, that movie was amazing.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this test. And I'm just curious on three or four movies that, you know, three or four movies that kind of fit into, or maybe movies that almost got there and you know, and you kind of were angry that didn't make that extra step.
So I'll talk about one that like super didn't pass at all and was like marketed towards Black people, but definitely was not made for us, which was on Prime, there's a series called Them.
Okay.
And I feel like it was
a fucking hard thing to watch.
Yeah, it was a lot of white producers trying to grab the audience that Get Out had and kind of pull from the same demographic of people, but not understanding the nuance of Get Out. And that a lot of the violence against Black people on Get Out and Get Out is off camera. So it's not exploitative and it's not torture porn. But Them, there was one episode that was directed by a Black woman and it was the most violent episode and it was unnecessary. And there's also no resolution at the end of the show. I think it was episode 6, but basically the main character, one of the main characters, she's a Black woman and she has like, she just has to watch her infant get murdered and it's on camera.
Yeah.
And I think it was unnecessary. I think it was basically just like trauma and torture porn.
Yeah.
And then there was no resolution or lesson at the end of it.
Right.
And it just felt like a bunch of white directors and producers trying to like hop on the Get Out train and then not understanding what made Get Out so successful. And it was really like to have people suggest it to me and you know, oh, have you seen this? It's so good. And then being like, oh, you don't understand, like, you just think there's Black people in the movie and it's about Black people and then that qualifies as like good enough for the community. But yeah, it was, I don't think it went over well with anybody in the Black community. I think we kind of wholly rejected it because it wasn't made for us. You know, they said it was made for us and it wasn't.
What were some other movies that did it right?
I think obviously, you know, Get Out kind of, I feel like brought a resurgence back to Black focused horror. The Blackening you mentioned was amazing. And it wasn't so I went to an early screening and they filled the audience with, you know, Black influencers and Black film fans. And there's like moments in the movie where like, I've never experienced this in a theater where like I could feel this like kinship with the entire audience. And there's a scene where one of the characters sings a Black national anthem. And the entire theater started singing it with her.
Oh, that's
amazing.
And it
was like one of the best experiences of my entire life. Like I'll remember that forever.
Oh, that's
there were so many jokes that were like completely over the head of anybody who wasn't Black. So it really felt like it was made for us. And like, sorry, spoiler alert, but like in the end, the character who dies like at the end is Black, but you know, it's not overly graphic. And I just thought that it was really done well. And it was like, it felt so much like it was just made completely only for the Black community. Yeah. And then I really love Nope. Nope is probably one of my favorite films. I love that it kind of transcends genres because it's a Western, it's a sci-fi movie, you know, it's a horror film. It's, you know, it has so much going for it. And it's kind of a cool example of like, yes, the main characters are Black and, you know, there is racism that is kind of subtle in the film. But it feels like a movie that as a Black person, I can just relax and watch and enjoy. And I know I'm in safe hands because it's a Jordan Peele film. So I'm not going to see, you know, graphic violence against Black people. And it's a setting that I've never seen them in, like a Western, you know, a Western sci-fi movie with Black people in it. And it is just like, oh, finally we get a movie where we can just like sit there and relax and be like enveloped into this universe that Jordan Peele created. And it's also really beautiful.
Did you see, I wanted to know if this passed the test. Did you see, I forget the show. It was a Lovecraft adaptation on HBO.
Oh, Lovecraft Country.
How did you feel like that handled all this stuff, if I can ask?
So there's this really, it almost felt like, yes, it was very violent. And there was a lot of violence in it, and you saw it on camera, but there was this phenomenon that happened when it came out because it dealt with our real history and a lot of stories that didn't get heard. So it had a purpose, right? Like all of this really bad violence had a purpose, which was just to teach people, you know, about the Tulsa massacre and a lot of these issues, like sundown towns. There's people who didn't, I lived in that sundown town. Glendale is still a sundown town considered. I mean, obviously they don't enforce it, but you know, where I grew up, and I grew up in a predominantly white community. So with Lovecraft Country, which was a Misha Green directed show, but it was under the umbrella of Jordan Peele and Monkey Paw. Yes, it was really violent and it was really hard to watch, but the purpose was, this is what happened to us. This isn't really being taught. And a lot of people don't know about this. So we're gonna show you this and we're gonna show you uncensored. But I noticed within that series, after going through like all this traumatic, like visuals, there was always a scene of relief directly afterwards.
Yeah.
So like, I remember there's like a really violent scene. And then we see this scene of these queer and trans characters just enjoying life. And it was like, all right, we showed you and taught you about this really traumatic thing. Now let's give you like immediately, let's give you something that has joy in it. And so then this phenomenon started happening in the Black community that there was all, especially on Twitter and in Facebook groups, where we would watch it together. Like we'd all watch it when it came out, and then we go into our groups or we go on Twitter and we discuss it and we discuss our history. And it was kind of like this cathartic, like, I don't want to say healing, but it was like this discussion and confrontation of the reality of our history. And like, I don't explain. It was almost like all going to church after something where we discussed our trauma, we discussed our history, we talked about what we liked, we talked about the scenes of joy. And I just felt like there was this huge phenomenon of connection within the Black community when that show came out.
I mean, I think you bring up a really good point about like, I don't know. I mean, I'm super not happy about how Florida is handling education.
Yeah.
Nor the rest of the fucking country at this point. And I feel like what you're talking about is, you know, maybe something isn't perfect, but if at least it leads to conversation, there's something to be learned. And this attempt to cut out the conversation to me is just, why do you think they're, what they're doing in Florida? Why do you think they're doing that? I guess if I could ask you, I don't know if it's too leading of a question or not.
Kind of parallel to like, I was talking about like backlash with this shifting of the male gaze to like a more broad spectrum of like queer gaze and a female gaze. And I think it's kind of parallel where people got really vocal about oppression, and we were starting to get our own platforms and discuss it. And then, you know, honestly, I feel like Trump got elected and gave people permission to be openly bigoted and feel empowered in it. And now we're seeing kind of this backlash against all this work that was done to try and undo systems of oppression. And people are taking it and running with it. And I don't know, because I feel like the Black Lives Matter movement had this resurgence in 2020 and it got really big and everyone kind of hopped on board. And then a lot of the people who claim to like you know, want to fight for that fizzled out. And now it's just this like small group of us and people who are, I feel like people slid back into complacency. And I feel like that allowed for people who felt empowered in their bigotry to kind of take the reins and do with it what they wanted.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else you want to share in terms of just, you know, I don't know, just the magazine? Is there anything you want to plug in terms of the work you're doing, whether or your team, whether it's based in the magazine or not?
Yeah, we are actually having a launch party October 5th.
Okay.
At the Stand Theater in Los Angeles. And so that's when the magazine volume 2 is launching. It'll be available online. The link to it is in my bio. All of my socials are at Ashleta. And yeah, this issue, I feel like we're really kind of starting to hone in on our skills and our editing skills, our layout skills. I think the every shoot we do, I feel like is better than the next one. Yeah, I'm really excited for this issue. And I think a lot of the articles in it are really important. Yeah.
That's great.
I think it's going well. It's kind of scary because I'm not like used to, you know, having all my ducks in a row and like people turning in things early and, you know, having my layouts ready to go. But I think it's going to be a really good issue. I think it's going to like elevate a lot of artists that I feel like deserve a platform and deserve to be, you know, to have people be aware of them. So, yeah.
Our podcast is still growing, but you know, we have a good platform to share stuff, and this is perfect. And I really appreciate your time. I'm glad this became a longer thing, and I really
thank you for having me.
And Ashleta, am I pronouncing it?
Yep. Cool. Yeah.
Thanks so much. You have awesome. A great day. Great meeting you, Ashleta.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye bye.
Bye.
Hello, and thanks for joining us. Welcome to season 2. We've got some amazing guests coming up. We've got 2 that I especially want to talk about. Anna Biller made a film called Viva, and then did a movie called Love Witch, and just did a book called Bluebeard's Castle. And everything about Anna's work really fits the world we're in. I mean, they made their own costumes and sets for their first 2 films. They are very unique talent, just, you know, pleasure, very smart, knows more about old films and art. I mean, you know, it's an encyclopedia of knowledge, and they are really, I'm one of my favorite artists. You know, I say artists because they're a filmmaker, but there's so much art in all of it, as you can tell. They shot on film at a time when it's not easy and not cheap. So they are a guest coming up around the November 2nd. And then we're also putting one out with Ileana Douglas. You might know her from films. I can't mention some of those films because we're still on strike and I'm trying to respect that. But they are also amazing. They made a book called Connecticut in the Movies. Another, I mean, honestly, they're probably, I would have to say they're one of the top 10 film scholars living today. But what's amazing about them is it's all very organic. I like how they've learned organically. I'm sure they've read a lot of books, but there's something very down home. When they're talking about film, you don't feel like they're talking at you, or, you know, it's very organic. It's very natural. It's just very much about their passion, and they can express it in such a great way. And again, that we're going to be covering an episode that covers a book, Connecticut in the Movies, which blew me away. I'm not a huge fan of like 30s, 40s, 50s movies, but her book really made me change my mind about that. So please come in and check those out, and many, many more coming out. I'm very proud of the work we're doing. And also want to give a thank you to Otter Castro. He's been our editor, but he's kind of coming more into researching, into producing, and we started interviewing together, and he's really great. So, you know, check, you'll see a lot more from Otter this season. Enjoy. Have a good week until next episode.
God indeed.